Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT. Bandwidth for the Tech Guy is provided by CacheFly. CacheFly.com. Hi, this is Leo Laporte, and this is my Tech Guy podcast. This show originally aired on the Premier Radio Networks on Sunday, February 23rd, 2014. This is episode 1060. Enjoy. The Tech Guy podcast is brought to you by ZipRecruiter. ZipRecruiter makes hiring faster, easier, and cheaper. Post your job to 50-plus job boards with one click. Try ZipRecruiter for a free 4-day trial right now at ZipRecruiter.com/TechGuy. That's ZipRecruiter.com/TechGuy. And by ShareFile. Enhance your workflow. Send files of almost any size easily and securely with ShareFile from Citrix. Try ShareFile today for a 30-day free trial. Go to ShareFile.com, click the microphone at the top of the page, and enter Tech Guy. Well, hey, 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 how are you today? Leo Laporte here, the Tech Guy. And it's time to talk tech. Computers, the internet, cell phones. I had to think about it. The internet, computers, cell phones, home theater. Our digital photography guru is coming up in just a little bit. Mr. Chris Marquardt, talk about digital photography. 8888-ASK-LEO. That's the number if you want to call with a question, a comment, a suggestion. It's toll-free from anywhere in the U.S. and Canada. Outside that area, though, you know, you can still call us. In fact, we have listeners all over the world thanks to the internet. You can always use your Skype or voice over IP product of some kind. Tango, Viber, there's a lot of them. Don't think you can use WhatsApp. Did you see that WhatsApp was down for like hours yesterday?
What?
Yeah. I wonder, Mark Zuckerberg's probably going, it's like buying a car and you pull out of the lot and the engine falls out. It's like, what? I spent $16 billion for this car. And the engine just fell right out of it. I'm sure it's just a minor glitch. Probably what it is script kiddies. That's what we call the kind of non-sophisticated, non-intelligent hackers who are at least just smart enough, barely smart enough to run somebody else's hacking script, launching what we call a distributed denial of service. Welcome to the dark side of the internet. Distributed denial of service, or DDoS, or DDoS attack. It's very easy to do nowadays, particularly because there's recently we've discovered some serious vulnerabilities in the way the internet's constructed. A guy with a very poor internet connection, a megabit internet connection. That's nothing, right? You have more than that. Megabit internet connection can launch an attack of upwards of 400 gigabits per second. 400 billion bits per second against a site. By doing that, these are called amplification attacks. By doing that, of course, most sites you have that much bandwidth aimed at you are going to go down. Now, WhatsApp must have a lot of cleverly designed bandwidth because they have 500 million users. So they certainly have figured out a way to handle millions, tens of millions of messages a minute. And that's the kind of traffic we're talking about. So whatever attacked them or brought them down, if that's what happened, maybe somebody blew it, pushed the wrong button. Seems unlikely. But if that's what happened, then I'm sorry. You heard about this, right? So Facebook, Mark Zuckerberg, he's got crazy money. I call it stupid money. The kind of money, so much money that you can spend it dumbly and survive. He spent 10% of his company. 10% of his company's valuation, Facebook's valuation, on a smartphone app. What? Not only that, a smartphone app that really didn't make very much money. I think it made, what was it? I read it somewhere. 40 million last year, something like that, 400 million. Even if they made $1 billion last year, you'd take 19 years to pay it back. So what Zuck did is they gave $12 billion, you do the math here, $12 billion U.S. worth of Facebook stock, because it's kind of inflated right now, so that was easy. $4 billion in greenbacks, American dollar, $4 billion, and then promised another $3 billion over the next few years in stock for performance. So a total of potentially $19 billion. And remember when he bought Instagram for $1 billion, everybody went, whoa, I feel queasy. That's nothing. Remember when Snapchat turned down $3 billion and everybody, including me, said, they're crazy, they should take their money and run? Yeah, maybe they weren't so crazy. Robert Reich, the former U.S. Secretary of Labor, says that that acquisition, the $19 billion acquisition, is everything that's wrong with the U.S. economy.
What?
He writes in the Salon, if you ever wonder what's fueling America's staggering inequality, the income inequality, ponder Facebook's acquisition of mobile messaging company WhatsApp for $19 billion, the biggest price paid for a startup in history. That's $3 billion more than Facebook raised when it was first listed, more than twice what Microsoft paid for Skype, twice what Microsoft paid for Skype. He says, given that giant amount, you might wonder, well, WhatsApp must be a pretty big company, right? Tens of thousands of employees worldwide. No, 55 employees in Mountain View, California. What Facebook bought was 450 million users all around the world. And all around the world is kind of underscore that. WhatsApp, you may not even have heard of it. I bet you haven't. A lot of people haven't, unless you have friends overseas, because it's not widely used in the U.S. We're pretty content using either text messaging or the messaging apps that came with our smartphones, like Facebook Messenger, Google's Hangouts, Google Messenger, Apple's Messages. That's what people in the U.S. use. But around the world, WhatsApp is very popular because it does things those can't. First of all, it sends text messages without using text messaging infrastructure. It just uses the internet, plain old data. You could send not just text, but pictures, audio, video. My friend Alan Tepper, who is Castilian, he's from Spain, he says he likes it because it can handle the diacritical marks over letters, you know, the accents and circumflexes and things, better than most text messaging apps can. It is very popular in Russia because it handles Cyrillic. It's very popular in Israel because it can go right to left instead of left to right, and it handles non-Roman characters. So this is what Facebook bought. Robert Reich says its value comes from two other things that require only a handful of people. First, it's technology, a simple but powerful app. Now, I would say, Robert, you probably don't know much about technology because it's not that complicated. In fact, Facebook's already purchased a very similar app called Beluga many years ago. They have that technology. Facebook Messenger does everything that WhatsApp does. So that's not particularly impressive. That's not what they bought it for. WhatsApp Messenger, that's nothing. They bought Beluga in 2011 and basically turned it into Facebook Messenger. It did all the same exact things. Oh, by the way, Facebook bought it and killed it. I was a Beluga user. I liked Beluga, and that was it. We don't know exactly what they paid for Beluga, but it probably was not more than $100 million. In fact, you know, WhatsApp wasn't very valuable either. Its investors had valued it, I think, at $1 billion or two just very recently. Nobody expected $19 billion. The second reason Robert Reich said Facebook bought WhatsApp, and I think he's right on this one, is what's called the network effect. That's what made Facebook so big. The more people use it, the more other people use it because your friends and family are using it, so you have to use it. That's what makes any instant messenger a success. It's why in the United States, originally we used, remember, ICQ? But that was big in the U.S. Outside the U.S., in Canada, for instance, everybody used Microsoft Messenger. That was the big app. And because all your friends were on it in Canada, that's what you used. Messenger never really took off in the U.S., but it was big in other countries. There have been many of these. WhatsApp is growing fast. Its worldwide usage did just double to 450 million. And it's growing by about 1 million users every day. I would guess after the announcement this week that Facebook just bought them, they've probably gained more than that. I re-downloaded. I hadn't used it in ages. I re-downloaded it. Now, get this. On one day, the last day of the year, 2013, it handled 54 billion messages in one day. In one day. Why is it bad for the economy? Well, we'll find out. Because I didn't even get to that part of his article. Leo Laporte, the tech guy, your calls. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. 8888-ASK-LEO. That's my phone number. 888-827-5536. Just to wrap this WhatsApp deal up, the reason former Secretary of Labor under Bill Clinton, Robert Reich, says it's a bad idea is because those $19 billion that Facebook spent to acquire an app. It's a smartphone app. And I guess, you know, mostly the smartphone app's users. Makes no new jobs, adds nothing to the economy. It's funneling the money that Facebook raised in its stock offering from investors right into WhatsApp. Now, if you bought Facebook stock and you're an investor, that's the kind of thing you gave them money to do, I guess. And you better hold on. I think it's crazy money. I think it's stupid money. I think it's a complete waste of money. There are many, many cases in the industry. Most notably, America Online buying Time Warner for much more money, of just wasted money. And I'm sure that's really what Robert Reich is thinking. This is just throwing your money away. On the other hand, there are 55 employees who are 100 millionaires and two founders who are multi-billionaires who are very happy today. Very, very happy. And if I were a Facebook stockholder, I'm not. I don't buy tech stock so that I can be objective about all this stuff. And you don't, more importantly, so you don't think, well, Leo's got a stake in this. I don't have a financial stake in any tech companies. But if I were a Facebook stockholder, I'd be concerned. 10% of the company on an app? That's a lot of money for an app. And by the way, an app, the technology of which they already have, what they don't have is the 450 million users. But I have to point out, and I think Facebook knows this, in fact, this is really what scares the heck out of them, is those users are only there until something better comes along. And what the Facebook's painfully aware of that, because they put MySpace practically out of business when they came along. The problem with the network effect that we were talking about earlier, you're there because your friends are there, is if your friends all leave, you follow. And it happens very abruptly. It can happen almost instantaneously. How many people still use ICQ? Everybody used it for a while. Nobody uses it now. It's still around. People move on. And the problem is it's the influencers in this are often young people who are notoriously fickle. So I'd hate to spend up to $19 billion on something that in 6 months could have, you know, 100 million users or 10 million users easily. Easily. 8888-ASK-LEO. What do you think? It's not just me. It's you, too. What do you think? 8888-ASK-LEO. Did you, Heather Hammond, Phone Ranger, did you install WhatsApp?
I did.
And what do you think?
I didn't use it yet.
You don't know anybody who uses it.
Maybe
that's why.
I don't.
There's no network effect there because it's not widely used in the U.S. I used it only because I was chatting with people overseas, and they like it, and so I use it.
Oh, okay.
I'll add you.
Yeah, let's WhatsApp.
Let's WhatsApp each other.
Or something.
It's, you know, the one thing that makes it a little different than, say, Facebook Messenger is the way you identify a person is by phone number. And it uses, so it's essentially like Facebook, except instead of you adding friends with WhatsApp, it's whoever's in your contact list. So it goes out, looks at your phone's contact list, and now you can message any of those people or invite others to a message.
Good thing
you.
I wasn't playing with it last night.
I don't want to know. What were you doing?
I had a couple beers. I would have been like, Leo.
Yeah, you don't want a drunk WhatsApp.
Leo,
I don't know. I have no idea about that. But you can do that because so why do kids use Snapchat? Take a quick picture, send it off. That's the kind of thing they use WhatsApp for. Some people say, oh, it's going to make money. It could make money because they could use it for transactions in countries where banking isn't easily available. You know, and credit cards aren't widely used. So India or China, it's not very popular in China, oddly enough. They have their own Chinese WhatsApp. Maybe Facebook will buy that too. Who should I talk to before we go on and on this?
We have to talk to David and Reseda because it's such an interesting question.
All right. David and Reseda, Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Hi, David.
Hey, Leo. So I got an LED Vizio refurbished, and I turned it on for the first hour, turned it off. It was all right. Turn it back on and maybe had it on for 2 hours, and the room started smelling like burnt marshmallows, like s'mores. I don't know if that's normal.
That's not normal. Did you see any smoke coming out of it?
No, not at all.
But you just smelled that way. And it continued to operate okay?
Yeah, perfectly. Netflix was perfect.
Okay. It may be that it is, as it heats up, of course, off-gassing a little bit of something. I don't know what. It generally, when electronics first comes on, you might have a small amount of odor, but you really shouldn't smell s'mores. And my fear is it will, in fact, start smoking. And if it does, immediately turn it off. Did you get it from Vizio?
No.
Okay.
It's refurbished.
Yeah, but not by Vizio. So my strong advice, and I've said it many times before, is refurbished can mean a lot of things. In this case, I can almost promise you whoever sold it to you got it back because it had a problem. Maybe it was smoked. Maybe it smelled like s'mores. And they just sold it back to you. They didn't refurbish it. They just maybe they put it in a nicer box. They put it in a new box. That's why when you get refurbished, always get refurbished from the manufacturer. Because generally what will happen is the manufacturer will warranty it as if it's new. And this is what you really hope for in this case because I fear that something is not right. This is not normally what you want. You do not want your TV to smell like s'mores. When manufacturers sell refurbs, Apple, Vizio, Dell, often they're just computers that were sold, shipped to the consumer. The consumer opened it and then got regret. And state law in California, in fact, law in many states, says you cannot sell an open box like that as new. Even though it may never even have been turned on. It could have been returned right away. But as soon as the box is opened, it's not new anymore. That's the law requires that. So they sell it as refurbished with some discount. When you get it from the manufacturer, chances are that's what you're getting, especially if you're getting a current model and it has a full warranty. I don't like getting third-party refurbs. I really don't. My guess, and I think Bash is right in the chat room, that you should look at the capacitors under the heat sink of the power supply, if you really feel like investigating. If there's a little oil on them, if they're leaking, then you really got a problem. And this, I think, is what's probably happening. If the capacitors are leaking, the oil that's coming out of them is getting heated and vaporized, and you're smelling s'mores, eventually they'll fail. It's also possible that somebody did use it to make s'mores, and a little bit of chocolate and marshmallow dripped into the inside, and that could be harmless. I don't know what happened to it. I can pretty much guarantee you this is not how Vizio envisioned it. And I've had several Vizio TVs. None of them smelled like graham crackers, marshmallow, and chocolate. None of them. So something's wrong. You should take it back. Hope that they will take it back. Often when you get it from a third party, it's as is. In that case, cross your fingers. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Our show today brought to you by ZipRecruiter. I should mention ZipRecruiter. This is a great idea. If you're looking for work or you know somebody who's looking for work or you are an employer looking for employees, ZipRecruiter makes it easy. There are a lot of job boards out there. Where do you start? ZipRecruiter. It will file your listing at 50-plus job boards with a single click of your mouse. And it does more. Because it also posts your job on the social networks like Facebook, LinkedIn, Twitter, Google+. We've used them, and with great results, by the way. They'll add your company logo and colors to make your job pages an extension of your business. You can add unlimited users to your account, create an instant job page on your website, include a company careers page to use as a careers link. It's so easy. You post once, and you watch the qualified candidates roll in to the ZipRecruiter interface. Very easy to use. ZipRecruiter.com. It also it does a little parsing and automatically highlights the best candidates. You screen them, rate them, and hire the right person fast. If you have to do hiring, ZipRecruiter is great. And right now, you could try ZipRecruiter free for a 4-day trial. Go to ZipRecruiter.com/techguy. ZipRecruiter.com/techguy. And you can try it free for 4 days and get a sense of what ZipRecruiter can do for you. It's so efficient, so fast, so easy. You probably have your employee hired in 4 days. ZipRecruiter, ZipRecruiter.com/techguy. The best way to post jobs. Look at all the places it posts them. So good. So good. Leo Laporte, the tech guy, 8888 Ask Leo. Eric is next in Corona, California. Hi, Eric. Leo Laporte here.
Hi. My question is, do you know or can you recommend a good company for data recovery on a RAID 5 server?
So you have a RAID 5 server more than one disk died.
Yes.
Oh, man. I don't know if data recovery is even possible. RAID 5 is designed to allow failure of a disk because of data redundancy. But if too many disks fail at the same time, then you've lost enough data that the recovery can't be, you know, you can't add another disk. I don't know of anybody who specializes in RAID recovery. Anybody in the chat room have any suggestions? You know, I know, of course, a company like Drive Savers, which specialize, you might call them anyway. They're friends of mine down the road a piece. They specialize in single drive recovery.
Yeah, I was looking and I saw that there were companies that claim RAID 5, but then I go to the reviews and you start seeing that they're not true. So.
Yeah, I mean, I guess one way to do it would be to take the disks that failed and try to get them back and running. Depends why they failed. So Drive Savers is very expensive, and I don't recommend it for what I call soft failures. Failures due to data being incorrectly written on the drive or something like that. They're so expensive because they fix hardware failures. You know, the platters get scratched, or which would make it difficult to recover, by the way. But let's say it's not that. Maybe the bearings died in the platters. The data is still on the platters. They just won't spin because the bearings wore out. Well, Drive Savers has a clean room environment. This is why it's so expensive. They take it apart. They have replacement parts for all kinds of hard drives. They put they put the platters in with new bearings. And it all works fine because your data never got hurt. It's just the drive couldn't spin because the bearings failed. So it's very dependent, and that's why I wouldn't trust these reviews, on the kind of failure you had. Drive Savers and no data recovery company, you know, they're not magicians. They're things they can do. But there's some kinds of failures. You know, if there's a gouge, let's say the head on hard drives floats above the disk, never touches the disk. Let's say that you had a head crash where it hit the disk, gouged out a chunk of material. Well, that data's lost. No data recovery company can get it back. It's gone.
Right.
So it really it's dependent on the kind of failure you had. And, of course, you don't know. It's hard to tell. Was there a rattling? Why did two drives fail at the same time? That's the question.
I don't know.
Power surge or something?
Probably, because I got a call that the server rebooted first.
Yeah.
All I got. And then the next call I got is the server didn't come back up.
So. Yeah, I've had this happen to me. But, of course, we always have backups. You don't have a backup, huh?
We had backups for most of it, but there was one particular thing that wasn't on the backup.
Yeah. You also can lose a controller, and that can cause it. But that's easy because you replace it. The data is still on the hard drive. It really is. Even on servers, even on RAID 5 servers, to trust that and say, hey, it's RAID 5. What could possibly go wrong? Well, the RAID array could explode and all the disks could be blown up. Backups are always critical. One copy of anything, I don't care on how magical that thing is not enough. So I would call Drive Savers. I know them. They're great guys. They're not going to rip you off. They're the guys that got a lot of press because they hired a couple of years ago a counselor from a suicide hotline, a specialist in grief counseling because, well, You can hear it in Eric's voice. When you have that, when you have that file and it's gone forever, sometimes somebody who can say, breathe deep, it's going to be okay. You're still on the planet. It's scary. I don't know what to say. I would call them and see. And tell them Leo mentioned it. They're not an advertiser. I've just known him for years. And say, look, this is what happened. If you don't do RAID 5 recovery, who does RAID 5 recovery? Essentially, drive savers would do, I would guess, is look at the individual drives to try to get them back. Because then you could then the RAID array is intact and you can get the data off. The way RAID works means that data may be on different disks and so forth. And so it's a little tricksy. I don't have a good answer for you, Eric. You have my sympathy. I'm not berating you for not having a backup. I'm just using you as an example to everybody that this is why you got to have a backup, just because something's a RAID 5. And I've lost data on my servers. Absolutely. It's happened to me. And I learned the lesson. It only happens if you're paying attention. It should only happen once. And ever after, I have regular data backups to a separate data center, not even to the same building. My servers are in Seattle. I'm on a company called SoftLayer, and we back it up to servers in Dallas. Now, if the if the entire continent's nuked, well, then I guess I'll lose my data. But that's I figure at that point I don't really care anyway. 8888 ask Leo. There are a number of other companies that do this, and I'm just not familiar with them. I've used Drive Savers. I don't know the rest of them. UJ in the chat room saying, my hard drive failed.com. You know, whenever I see a domain, a vanity URL like that, I think, I don't know. That makes me a little nervous. But maybe that's one to try. iPad 22252 says, crawlontrack.com, crawlontrack.com. Drive Savers does do RAID data recovery. So they'd be the first people I'd call. They're absolutely trustworthy. Michael, Long Beach, California. Leo Laporte, the tech guy.
Hello, Leo. How are you today?
I'm well. How are you?
Good. I have two questions, and if they're fast, maybe I have a third.
Okay.
But first of all, I have IDX extensions on a lot of my files in my picture folder.
Yeah, that's Index.
I figured it's Index, but I don't know. Can I just get rid of those?
Yeah, you generally can. Those aren't the actual original images. What program do you use to keep track of your images?
Well, I'm not very. I used to use AC/DC, but then when I went to Windows 7, that doesn't work. So now I'm not using anything.
It could be Windows itself that's making the index. You know, when you have a picture folder, Windows is smart enough to say, "Oh, it's a folder full of pictures. I'm going to make thumbnails. I'm going to make an index." But generally, and I don't know of any program that. Generally, deleting the index file doesn't do anything except delete the index file. So whatever search program you were using or cataloging program, it's going to say, "Oh, I just lost my catalog. I don't know what you got."
Okay. My other question is, I'm trying to back up all of my documents and pictures, and how I do that is I have a separate hard drive, a 1 terabyte hard drive.
Good.
That has all my pictures.
Good.
And then I just get another terabyte hard drive, and I just copy them all over. But then next month, when I go to copy ones that are new, how do I do that? Because
you're very close to the perfect solution. It's exactly what I do. So, but I use a drive synchronization program. So, periodically, I always have on my desktop computer. I use Lightroom as my photo.
I have that one too. Yeah,
yeah, whatever you use doesn't matter. So when I get home from a day of shooting, I take out the memory card. I import it into Lightroom. Lightroom moves all the files into a hierarchy on my local hard drive. I then automatically have that synchronized. And I'll tell you a few programs that'll do this automatically, to a second external hard drive. And then once a week, I swap that external hard drive with another one, which I bring to work. So this is a complete backup up to last week, basically, of everything that's at home in case I lose everything at home. But let me talk a little bit about synchronization, because that's the key. Leo Laporte, the tech guy, right after this. Leo Laporte, the tech guy, 8888 Ask Leo. We're talking about backup. We always do. It's a great subject. With Michael, he takes photographs, and he wants to save those photographs. And if they're very valuable, I always look to what pros do, because a professional photographer, you're a wedding photographer, you cannot afford to lose those pictures. If you're a pro, your livelihood is on this, these guys know. And by the way, after I import the pictures in Lightroom and I put them on the hard drive, I don't wipe the memory card right away. I don't wipe it until I need it, and I have maybe 8 of them. So I rotate through them. So I even have another copy on the memory card if I needed to go back to originals sometime in the next few weeks. So the idea is you've got 3 copies now. I have the original on my computer. I have a backup right next to it on a hard drive. That's online all the time, so it's always available. And then I have the offsite copy on a hard drive. And you can use Carbonite for this. It's just that I have so many pictures, it's faster for me just to copy it to an external hard drive and then swap this periodically, bring it in and swap it with the duplicate hard drive at home. Now, the key is the synchronization software, right? Are you on Windows, Michael, or Macintosh?
Windows 7.
Oh, yeah, I knew that. You said it. So there's 3 different programs, depending on how fancy you want to get. Microsoft makes a free one that works pretty well. It's called SyncToy. And if you Google SyncToy, you'll get it right away. And that's free. There are shareware programs that I like better. They're a little more sophisticated. My friend Jeff Needles says SyncBack is the one he likes to use. And that is from 2brightsparks.com, the number 2brightsparks.com. And they have a free version. And if you like the free version, then you can get the shareware SE version, or they even have a pro version. There's 3 editions. You know, the free is probably going to do everything you need. For years, I've also used a program called Second Copy. Same idea. All 3 of them do the same thing. Second Copy is from Centered Systems. They look at the files, and they are basically duplicating. They're making duplicate folders on the external drive and the internal drive. One thing you want to be careful about, though, all of these have the capability, if you delete a file on the internal drive, to delete it on the external drive. You do not want that. Do not sync deletes. Only you want to have a super copy on the external drive. So if you delete a file locally, you still have the copy. It's pretty straightforward. So I run this on a schedule periodically. SyncToy, because it's free, one of the things that's missing is a scheduler. You have to use the built-in Windows scheduler. Some people say that's easy. Some people find it a little tricky. Second Copy has a built-in scheduler. I'm sure SyncBack does as well. So it will run, say, nightly. It's really nice to have that. In fact, not just for photos, but documents too. Anything that you want to make sure you always have a copy of. Does that make sense?
Okay, that's great. Do I have time for one?
Why not?
Okay. I just went from XP because you told me to.
Good.
I bought a copy of Windows 7 Professional.
Good man.
And how I put it, I do things kind of probably not the right way. What I did is I bought another hard drive, and I put it in, and it was Drive F. And when Windows went to put it on, I told it to put it on Drive F.
Good.
So now I have it on there, but for me to, if I just start the computer up, it goes up into...
Yeah, you have to convince the computer that your boot drive is the new drive, not the old drive.
Well, I hit F12, and when it comes up, I tell
pain.
It to Windows 7.
Yeah.
Now, but when I went to XP and I tried to do something, I don't see all of my hard drives.
Could be that XP doesn't, maybe the hard drive's too big. XP could only handle, I think, 2 gig drives, things like that.
Well, it's two terabytes.
Yeah, it probably, XP says there's no such thing as a 2 terabyte drive. What are you, nuts?
Oh, okay.
What are you, crazy? That's all. I just can't see it because it's so.
And I love your show and
thanks.
Good listening to you.
So you can, flip flop. The drives, instead of having it be, you know, switch the, it depends on the computer. In some computers, flopping the connectors, it will boot in order down the connector. So you just make it, you know, the boot drive be the F drive by swapping the connectors. Sometimes
so
you can just do it.
SATA works like that?
No, SATA does not. That's IDE. So if you're, okay, so you have a fairly recent XP computer and you have SATA, you could switch the boot order in the BIOS.
Okay. All right.
And just say, hey, start this drive, and you won't have to press the F12 and all of that.
Okay, but if I want to go back I'll have to do that if I want to go to XP.
Yeah, well, yes, exactly. You have a dual, you've created, without your intention, but you did it very nicely, what's called a dual boot machine that gives you the choice.
Okay, I just want to make sure I did.
That's a good idea. Now, because you got Windows 7 Pro, you also have XP emulation built into Windows 7 Pro.
I haven't figured that out.
Yeah, unless you need it, I wouldn't.
Okay.
I wouldn't.
That's why I have the XP. Now I can just go over to XP and use a program over there.
That's right.
Yeah.
But just don't go online with it.
Right.
Because it's after April 8th, XP is going to be unsupported, and there will undoubtedly be all sorts of exploits just floating on the internet waiting for you, waiting for somebody with XP to sign on.
Yeah, you just made me think of that. I probably wouldn't have even thought of that because, you know, even when we're off the computer, or when we turn the computer on, we don't think we're online. We're online. You have to physically go to your router and turn it off, right?
Yeah, I mean, generally, look, if you're running Windows 7, you don't have to worry. If you've booted into Windows XP, I would disconnect, physically disconnect it from the internet before you do that.
Right, that's what I'm saying.
Yeah, because so normally a bad guy has to get you to run software to corrupt your machine. He has to trick you, you know, give you a fake flash installer and you run it and it's not, and it's, now you got malware. That's the normal course of events. Exploits like these that we're talking about, the whole point of them is to get stuff on your computer without your knowledge or running anything. Just kind of float in and do it. And
I don't know how many times I've missed inheritances. I've had millions of dollars.
That's right. That's one way. Just click here and you will be a rich man. So that's one thing. And that's going on all the time. And if you are, I don't want to say dumb. If you're gullible, if you're nice enough to run those programs, you know, if you're a nice person, you're trusting enough to run those programs, you will get bit. But what will happen after April 8th is Microsoft's going to stop patching Windows XP. There are bad guys right now, I guarantee you, who have a little briefcase full of ways to get XP to do what they want. Exploits, we call them, because they exploit flaws in the operating system. They know these already. They don't want to release them into the wild because Microsoft will fix them. After April 8th, anything goes, boys. And furthermore, every time Microsoft patches other versions of Windows, like Windows 7, Vista, and 8, it is an announcement to the hacker community, because often these flaws exist in XP as well, that maybe you should check this. So there are going to be, over the months to come, lots of new ways to get into your system by you just viewing a web page, for instance. So if you're not online, they can't do anything. But once you get online, usually just a computer sitting online is safe. But again, I can't promise that. If it's behind a router, you're probably okay, because they'd have to hack the router and then hack you. But of course, we're learning a lot of routers, including Linksys routers, which are the most commonly purchased routers, have major security flaws in them, which will never be patched because it's hard to patch a router. And the companies just ignore it. So it isn't hard to imagine a scenario where your XP machine's just sitting online and suddenly the bad guy has control of it. And then what do they use it for? Well, they could try to steal stuff from you. Most likely, though, they use it as part of a zombie army, like this attack against that we were just talking about, against WhatsApp. If it really was a DDoS, we don't know. It was down for a long time. Usually that means it was. If it was a DDoS attack, it was done by an army of computers just like that, zombie computers. Their owners didn't know they were being used maliciously. Their owners probably didn't know they were infected. But they were, and they were waiting for commands from the bad guy. And generally, the command is something on the order of attack this system. So, yeah, Michael, if you have XP, and anybody listening, if you have XP, either do as Michael did and upgrade to a newer version of Windows, which has continued to be supported by Microsoft, or get a new computer, or don't go online with your XP machine. You could put Linux on there. You could do something else as well. But XP. Now, remember, antivirus companies are going to continue to, in fact, Microsoft even is going to continue to update its antivirus. But that's not really the issue. These holes are what's really scary, because they allow a bad guy to attack you and you don't even know it. You might not even be on the computer in some of the worst cases. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. More of your calls coming up right after the word from your local stations. Well, hey, 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 how are you today? Leo Laporte here, the tech guy. Time to talk about computers, the internet, smartphones, all that jazz. 8888 Ask Leo. That's the phone number, 33 and 3rd. After the hour, we will talk to Chris Marquardt, our digital photographer on digital photography. 8888 Ask Leo. That's the number if you want to get in line and get talking here. That's what Josh did in Cincinnati, Ohio, our next caller. Hi, Josh.
Hi, Leo LaPorte. How are you doing?
I am very well. How are you?
I'm doing not too bad. It's about 40 degrees here, so it's a little chilly.
Wow, that springtime has hit Ohio.
Yeah, it is. It's a heat wave around here.
What can I do for you?
I was wondering, between you and Kevin Smith, the director, I have gotten it in my head that this year I want to start podcasting.
Yeah, Kevin does Smod. Actually, he has a whole empire now, doesn't he? He's Smodcast.
Yes, he does. Between Twit and him, that's all my podcasting that
I can
do.
It's kind of interesting because he was the silent guy in his movies.
Yes, indeed he was. He can ramble, though.
Jay and Silent Bob, right? Yeah, but on the podcast, the guy never shuts up.
Exactly.
So I guess he had a lot stored up.
Dichotomy.
Yeah. It's interesting that somebody as famous and successful would do podcasts, as Kevin Smith would do podcasts. Mm-hmm. But I think what he likes, you know, he's made enough money, right? What he likes is the freedom that the podcasting allows. I don't like the word podcasting because we've gone way beyond putting this on an iPod. In fact, the iPod's dying. Even Apple, you know, acknowledges the iPod sales were cut in half this year. People put, you know, podcasts on other devices like their smartphones. What they are really is just downloadable audio from the internet, or video can be as well, that you can watch at your convenience on other devices. It's really audio on demand or video on demand. That's what it is. And we do everything I do. For instance, this show is available after the fact on demand audio and video. And I have a whole network of stuff. So does Kevin Smith. How many shows does he have now?
I'm not sure. Quite a bit.
Yeah.
Quite a bit.
So we have 30 on the Twit network, but I bet you he's close. It's a fun business because it's democratic. You don't have to have radio towers or transmitters. All you need is access to the internet, and you have access to not just, you know, the people in your town or even the country, but all over the world. About a third of our listeners to this show and every show I do are outside the U.S. That's fantastic. Yeah. So you want to do so the first thing when people say, I want to do a podcast, first thing I say is don't expect to make money. It's a hobby.
Right. Of course.
I doubt Kevin Smith makes any money, and he probably has millions of listeners. Mm-hmm. But do it because you love it. The second thing I say is do whatever, you know, when you pick a topic for podcasting, do something you love deeply, passionate. The more passionate you are about it, the better. For two reasons. One, because your passion communicates to your audience, and presumably you'll attract people who have a similar passion for that topic. If it's Pez dispensers, knitting, or dwarf pygmy goats, it doesn't matter. But if you love pygmy goats, you know, you'll attract the other people who love pygmy goats, and then you've got a community. The other reason it's helpful to be passionate is because it's hard work. And it can be a little discouraging after weeks and months, and you don't get any emails from anybody. And it's nice to be doing something you really love, whether or not you get responses. So what is the subject you'd like to cover?
Well, I'm currently in film school. I'm about to graduate here in about 6 months. And so I really like watching TV shows, movies, and so kind of like reviews and stuff. And then I'm also into technology, obviously, because I listen to almost every Twitch show.
Thank you.
Wow, I want to talk about tech, the cool stuff, sound, and just life, movies, and tech.
There you go. I mean, the more diffuse it is, the more difficult it is to gain an audience because, of course, it's hard to, you know, you don't have an elevator pitch. You don't have that. But the more targeted it is, my experience, the better people understand what you're doing and the more likely you'll attract an audience. On the other hand, you're doing it for fun. Now, film school is interesting. Do you want to do video?
Yes. I'm going for digital filmmaking video production. Yeah. I don't really have a particular dream job. I just want to get into the industry and do something that I love.
Well, this is the wonderful thing about the new media. And I won't say podcast. I'll just lump it all together, new media, you know, because that includes YouTube and it includes podcasting. It includes people like me. I basically built an internet television and radio station, you know.
Exactly.
So there's a lot of different ways to do it. So I'll call it all new media. But the nice thing about new media is You know, in the old days, you graduate from film school. You go around in Hollywood trying to get a job, trying to find somebody. You probably end up doing films for companies or industrials. Or I have a friend, a kid that grew up, a good friend of my son. His name is Spencer Wardwell, and he dropped out of college because he loves filmmaking. And, of course, I'm sure he wants to make movies. But what he ended up doing is he found a website. It's kind of interesting, a regional website about the South. Let me see if I can find the website. SocietySouth.com, and he's become their filmmaker. So there's a lot of – one of the things that's happening is – and this might be one way to kind of think about doing this is partnering up with somebody who needs your skills, who wants to become – you know. So Society South, the idea is it's a website for people who live in the Southeast, the modern Southern experience. And they were smart. Not only is it a blog with text, but they do a lot of film. And they probably could do a podcast too. So those are the kind of people you might want to hook up with, somebody who's doing something you're interested in. Yeah. You know. So anyway, you didn't, what was your question? I guess I should ask that.
How should I get started? What's some vital equipment that I should get?
Well, okay, that's one of the reasons I asked audio or video. So audio is easy. You already have it, probably. You have a computer, a laptop even, and internet access. Yeah. You can, if you want, get fancy, get out a better microphone, but that's about it. And you know, if you really want to get fancy, there are podcast kits that include mixers and microphones and stuff.
Right.
Do you want to interview people like Kevin does, or do you want to just do it yourself?
Maybe eventually. Yeah. I just want to start out, just get my voice out there, really.
Yeah. So, you truthfully, a headset, an inexpensive headset will be fine. There are companies like Rode, R-O-D-E, that make excellent USB.
Yeah,
they're great. Rode Podcaster mic is a great microphone. Blue also makes some USB mics. The Blue Yeti is a great mic. Depends on how much you want to spend, but no more than a couple $100. And then you've got a great setup, headphones, and you record. And frankly, if you're doing video, YouTube's the place to go. But even with audio, there are places to go where you can post it. That's the big expense of doing this is bandwidth. But that's the nice thing about YouTube. If you add pictures, then you can put it on YouTube. So maybe put some pictures in there. But that's where it gets complicated, because now you got to get a camera. You probably already have one. You're a film student.
I do. Yeah, I have a T3i.
Oh, perfect. You know what's nice about these digital SLRs? They're four stills, but they do great video.
With Magic Lantern.
Yeah. So, okay, so you've got Final Cut. You've got Magic Lantern, which is a plug-in for Final Cut. You've got a great camera. Well, you're set. And now I would use YouTube, because it's free.
Okay.
The only negative on YouTube is they're going to put their own banner ads and sometimes even pre-roll ads on your stuff.
Yeah.
But
the age we live in.
Hey, that's the, you know, it, but everything's free, and that's a huge expense. You know, we on our podcast network, we use a company called Cashfly. They tell me we do 950 terabytes a month of downloads. That's more than 30 terabytes a day. If I had that's if you're just starting out, that's a $50,000 a month bill. You don't.
That's a lot.
But fortunately, you can build up slowly. And YouTube does it for free. If you could have that much on YouTube, and they would give you money, they'd be so happy.
Yeah.
Right?
Very true.
Make a nice website. Make a nice website so people can find it. I'm looking at the Society South website. It's beautiful. And, you know, these are just young people who set out, you know, they picked a topic, right? They said, we want to cover a region. That's a great way. They've got Instagram. They've got Twitter. They've got videos. You know, you can do this or you can do it with some friends. You are in a great position. Getting out of film school today, I think you are in the best position ever to have a wonderful career, because you don't need to go hat in hand to the money people. You don't need Steven Spielberg. You can do it yourself. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Leo Laporte, the tech guy, 8888. Ask Leo. We're talking high tech. We're talking computers. We're talking the internet. We're talking podcasting. It's actually kind of coincidental with our last call because Chris Hayes is sitting in the studio right now. He's visiting. He runs a company called Shout Engine, which is designed for podcasters, for audio podcasters, not video. You know, audio is so expensive, and you don't really want to compete with YouTube anyway. They own that space. But if you're an audio podcaster, they host it. Do you help people monetize it, or is it just
that's coming?
He's looking for startup funding, but they do a lot of the hard work, publishing, analytics, hosting for a podcaster. And they do it for free, which is nice. If you get more bandwidth, it can cost, but I guess you're going to an all-free model at some point. So for our last caller, this is interesting, shoutengine.com, shoutengine.com. That's fascinating. Good luck, Chris.
Thank you.
Yeah, yeah. This is to me, it's very exciting. And you know, when you have a new industry and or you're taking an existing model like print, radio, and TV and kind of reinventing it, it's disruptive. And there's always dislocation. And there's, you know, newspapers that are failing right now. It's challenging for the people who are new to it, using these new models to make a living. A lot of kids getting out of school who want to write or do video or audio can't make a living doing it because it's just, but it's in the middle of a change. We're in the middle of this complete ferment. This, you've seen this across the board. The internet disrupted almost everything. The last 20 years have been kind of nuts. If you're a travel agent, if you're a cable company, I mean, everybody. So this little slice of time isn't really a good way to judge it. I think in the long run, it's very exciting. It will democratize the media. Anybody will be able to do a radio show, a TV show, write a book, write a blog, and you won't have to go to the publishers, to the radio stations, to the movie companies to do it. You'll be able to do it on your own, and that's fantastic. People say, but then there'll be so much stuff. Yes, there'll be a lot of stuff. That's not a bad thing. Well, how do I find the good stuff? Oh, you will, because we're also developing social media at the same time, things like Twitter and Facebook that let people discover stuff. So a friend finds something that's really good, he tweets it or he puts it on Facebook, or she says, hey, you Pinterest, you got to try this. And so there are new methods for getting the word out as well, and I think they work quite well. It's all in flux, but I think that it's starting to gel. We're starting to understand it. Making a living is challenging, I understand, and that's why I tell people when they say I want to do a podcast, well, do it, but don't expect to make money at it. Do it because you love it. On the other hand, there are some, and I include myself in this, who've done quite well in podcasting. We've found a niche, we've found an audience, and have been able to make a living doing it. So it is possible. John in Melbourne Beach, Florida. You're next. Hi, John. Leo Laporte, the tech guy.
Hi, Leo.
Hey, John.
I'm new to your podcast. I haven't listened to it for that long.
Good. Well, welcome. It's nice to have you.
I have a question about a Macintosh SE that was given to me.
Wow, that's computers older than you are.
Yes, it is. It has a lot. I've gone through 3 hard drives on it. And I have no idea why, and I want to find out where I can get more hard drives.
Well, first of all, I don't think that, that Mac SE, I think when it came out, what did it have, a 10 megabyte hard drive or 20 megabyte hard drive?
30 megabytes.
30 megabytes. And what are you putting on it?
30 megabytes and 40 megabytes.
Well, where are you finding those, on eBay?
There's a local computer shop that sells old computer parts.
Oh, that's cool. So that's probably why they're failing. They're 20 years old, right?
Yeah.
I would look on eBay. You're going to have to get a drive that Mac can use. Is it an ID? Yeah, is it an ID? It's SCSI probably, isn't it?
Yes, it is SCSI.
SCSI, Small Computer Systems Interface. A couple of sites you ought to know about. Everymac.com. That's a great place to go to see every Mac ever made and the capabilities thereof. And there are advertisers on there who are aiming at people like you who collect old Macs. There's also one called lowendmac.com that is designed for people who have old Macintoshes.
I doubt I'd be doing anything useful on that.
What do you do with your SE?
Well, I just keep it around and do word processing and play those old Mac games.
Which is your favorite? Dark Castle? You ever play that?
Nope.
Oh, that's my favorite old Mac game. I don't know where you'd find a copy of that, but wow.
I have a copy of Mac Football, but that's about it.
You might be able to... does it have an... It has an external SCSI port, doesn't it?
Yes, it does.
You might be able to use a bigger, more modern drive with a SCSI interface.
The problem with using newer drives is, how do I get the operating system onto it?
Right. Right. That's, boy, you're a smart kid. You know, SCSI allows you to daisy chain. So you could have the operating system, a boot drive that is the 30 meg drive, and then daisy chain a larger drive off of that, then install the operating system onto the larger drive, perhaps, from there.
But how would I get it off the smaller drive onto the larger one?
Well, do you have an operating system installer?
No, I do not.
So you've just been copying it?
Yes.
Well, try copying it. So you know that SCSI, you can add, I think, up to 8 different SCSI devices. The only key on that is the last device has to have a SCSI terminator. Have you seen those little terminator plugs you plug into the SCSI port?
It's just a SCSI connector with a red X on it.
Yeah, there you go. So how old are you, John?
13.
That's awesome. So this is a hobby. You do it for fun. Do you have a more modern computer?
Yes, I have a MacBook Pro.
Oh, all right. So you're just doing this because it's kind of cool.
Yes.
I love it. What you need to do is probably find a classic Mac user group or something like that online, and then you could find other people who are also getting their Macs, their Mac SEs. When did that Mac SE come out? What year was that? 90? Well, it might have been 86, 87. I don't remember.
I don't really know very much history about it, but...
Yeah, go to everymac.com. They have all the details of every Macintosh ever made. Actually, we've just brought the site down. I think other people are doing that as well. 87, the chat room says, 1987. So it is a lot older than you.
Yes.
I think this is a great hobby. A great hobby. Where do you get more hard drives? I'm sure eBay would have more.
There's some links on the chat room that say stuff about hard drives that
I
see.
This was an 8 megahertz, 68,000 processor. Looked like the old classic Mac, except it had a little bit different front. It had a megabyte or two, not gigabyte, of RAM, and 800K floppy disks, and then the hard drive. Wow, what a great hobby. John, it's great to talk to you. Stay in touch. I love that. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Chris Marquardt is the photo guy, joins us each and every week at this time to talk about digital photography, to do some digital photographic myth-busting. We were talking about old Macintosh computers before the break. And Chris, I think you got your first Mac when?
2007.
Oh, so you don't count.
Yeah.
Seven years ago. You don't count.
Yes, I know. It doesn't count. It was OS 10 all the time, so I didn't even have OS 9 experience. So.
Yeah. I was just looking on everymac.com. This John's computer, this Mac SE, came out in 89. 87 was discontinued in 89. It was 8 megahertz, 68,000, 1 to 2 megs of RAM. If you were lucky, you had a 20 or 40 gig, 40 meg, sorry, no gigs here. Gig, we didn't know what gig meant in those days. Meg hard drive, dual floppies, 800K floppies. And for people who complain about computer prices, get this. Started the base unit, $2,900. Mm. Almost $3,000. And that's when a dollar meant something, 1987.
But that's still the price for a really good high-end computer. I think the prices haven't changed that much. They just burn their cycles a bit faster these days.
We always used to say that the computer you wanted always $2,500. But see, that's changed. So let me see. I'm going to say, what did I say? $2,900? $2,900 in 1987 converts to, what do you want to take a guess?
$5,000?
$6,000 in our money. In current money, $6,000 for that Mac SE. That'll put some of that in perspective.
How much is that in Bitcoin?
Today or last week?
Good question.
So Chris is the author of a great Lightroom. I've been going through it. It's a wonderful Lightroom tutorial series called Discover Lightroom. You can get that at discoverlightroom.com. He also has a short book version thereof. He also does great...
Of the workflow, yep.
Yeah, the workflow, which is the key.
1,000 pictures in 1 hour.
We were talking last hour about backing up photos and workflow and how... It's backing up or making sure those photos are protected is part of the workflow. You know, part of the workflow is going through the pictures you took, getting rid of the ones you don't want. But a lot of it is just making sure that you can get them again and you've put them somewhere.
And you're doing the right thing, leaving those pictures on the card until you use it next and cycle the cards. So the oldest card that you have still has pictures from maybe weeks or months ago.
Yeah.
So in case you miss a backup or something goes wrong, you can still go back.
That has saved me because mostly what happens to me is accidental deletion. Where I go, I just delete a whole folder and I go, oh, wow!
And especially when I travel, I now treat my cards like film. I fill them up and then I put them away.
Right.
And when I get home, I import them. I might do a backup on the road, but I'm not reusing cards on the road.
They're
I fill them up.
Yes. I don't get... Now, tell me if I'm wrong on this one. You can get 64 gigabyte SD cards now, even better, 128 gigabyte.
Sure.
But I do 32 gigs and nothing bigger. Because I don't want to rely too much on any one card, right?
You know, if you have a big new camera, those more high-end cameras, they have two slots. And what you can do is you can fill both of those slots with like a 64 gigabyte card and then have the camera write to both at the same time. So you have a backup built into the camera.
Yeah.
But if you have a smaller camera, I don't like to put too many eggs into one basket. So I'm looking at 8 to 16 gigabytes. That's kind of where I feel comfortable because then there are not too many pictures on a card in case it fails. But to be honest, I haven't really seen too many cards fail. So there's a bit of a hygiene thing. When you take your camera and you take the card out, if you open that card door, wait for a second or two before you actually pull the card out. Cameras will write for another second once you open the door. And when the camera is in the process of writing and you pull the card out in the middle of that, you might corrupt the card. So give it a second or two. Just
be patient.
Take one breath and then take the card
out. Many of us geeks are not good at. Patience.
I know.
Yeah. So what do you want to talk about today? Or you have a myth you want to bust? Or?
Well, it's a myth. We did talk about moon photography a while ago when there was this super moon. I'm making big air quotes here. But people still say, you can just point the camera at the moon and shoot it. Now, at this very moment, right now, we have a waning moon that is about 50% lit. So I thought we'd talk about moon photography again because this is actually a good time to take pictures of the moon. If you take pictures of the full moon, all you get is like a grayish surface with a bit of detail in it. But as soon as the light comes from the side, it's the same as in reality when you look around you. If you shoot with the light coming straight at someone, you don't get much depth and many shadows. If you have the light coming from the side, all of a sudden you have all the textures coming out. And the same happens with the moon when it's at about 50%. The light is coming straight from the side. And that means that at this boundary of the bright and the dark side of the moon, you will see the craters come out really nicely. And if you have, let's say, a 500 millimeter lens, 600 millimeters, that's when it kind of starts to get interesting on a DSLR, when you can take really cool moon photos that really show a lot of detail.
I love pictures of the moon, but you need a pretty long lens to get it right.
Well, unless you want, I wouldn't go below 600. If you want to fill,
who has a 600 millimeter lens?
Well,
there are
300 millimeter lenses and extenders. Some people do that, especially people who love to shoot wildlife and these kind of things.
Yeah.
That's something that they would typically have, or borrow one, get one from a friend for a few days. What the interesting thing is, you don't really need like 1500 millimeters because, I mean, yes, that will fill the screen, but today's cameras, first of all, they have so many megapixels, so it's easy to crop. The second thing is, if you put something interesting in the foreground, if the moon is really low above the horizon, if you put something interesting in the foreground, that will make for a more interesting picture with let's say, a few trees around the moon or something that gives you a bit more detail. Not just the moon because, there are millions of those pictures. But if you include something interesting, you will have more interesting pictures.
I always thought those were fake. The giant moon pictures.
This one doesn't really look that real. But, actually, it might be true. I mean, giant moon means long focal length. So this is the picture, the one that you just showed. It's probably 1,000 millimeters.
I just did a Google search for a giant moon. I don't know. I mean, this is the problem with Photoshop now. Nowadays, you can't really tell if somebody's faking it or not. I feel like these are kind of fake, but it is true. The moon.
I don't think it's fake.
The moon will look bigger. That's probably real. This is a moon rising over some buildings. It will look bigger.
The moon will look bigger over the horizon, right above the horizon. It will look bigger, but it is not actually bigger. The moon is actually just, in size, it's just half a degree. So it's really, really tiny. And so you will need a long focal length. And you will need to do some manual exposure, which is not that difficult, actually. There's a rule of thumb. So your camera's automatic exposure will fool you there. It will get it wrong. But there is, have you heard of the Sunny 16 rule?
No, what's that?
Well, it's an exposure rule. So if with old cameras they didn't have light meters built in. So what you would do is you would set the camera to the inverse of the ISO. So if you shoot at ISO 100, you shoot at a 1/100th of a second, and the Sunny 16 rule means shoot with that shutter speed at f/16, at the aperture of f/16.
Okay.
And then you have well exposed pictures in sunlight. There's another rule that's called the Looney 8. So if you shoot the moon, set your camera, again, the shutter speed to the inverse of your ISO. So if you shoot at ISO 400, set it to a 1/400th of a second.
Okay.
And use F8, and you will have a decent exposure. Well,
these are nice rules of thumb. Doesn't the camera do that automatically, though, for you?
The problem is that the camera, with the moon being this small, it pretty much only sees the black sky. It doesn't really know what's going on. It's not really programmed for that. So it will probably overexpose it, and then you end up with the moon being completely overexposed. And overexposure means there is no detail.
It's just
the moon.
A
you
white
don't get
dot.
The craters.
Yeah.
It's a white dot. There's no craters in it, but that's what you want. So,
Chris Marquardt, discoverthetopfloor.com. We will discover lightroom.com too for his workshop. We'll talk about our assignment when we come back. Thank you, Chris. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Hey, our show today brought to you by ShareFile.com. I'll tell you, because of the radio show, I'm constantly sharing audio files with radio stations all over the country. If you're in business, in fact, I would imagine that most business emails have an attachment of some kind or other. My recommendation, you've heard me say it over and over again, don't send attachments. It's dangerous for a lot of reasons. Lisa just sent me, I got to get her on ShareFile, just sent me an email that had, it was a CC, but she sent our accountant an email that had tax forms on it and stuff. We're doing our taxes. It bounced back. Happens all the time because it was too big. Of course, the other thing, and I've got to explain this, is when you send this stuff through the mail, through the email, it's public. Anybody along the way can read it. And that's, you know, you're sending tax forms. I wouldn't do that. If you're in the, you know, you're a physician, you can't send patient records that way. It's actually illegal. Violates HIPAA. ShareFile is HIPAA compliant. It's secure. You control the files. You control who can see them, for how long. You never get a bounce back because you're not sending the file as an attachment. You're sending a secure link. Now, if you're using Outlook, their plugin makes it look just like you're emailing the files, but you're not. It's a secure link. You have a folder. I have a ShareFile folder. Actually, I have several on this computer that automatically sync to ShareFile. So let me log into my ShareFile account, and I'll show you. So what I do is logging in. First of all, notice it's branded. It looks like a Twit page. You know, and down here, a little print, it says powered by ShareFile. These are files that I automatically synchronize from my desktop. They go out to the radio station. These are ads for this week. There was only one that I sent to the radio station. Now, watch how I do it. They actually get a notification when I upload a file. I've set it up so they get a notification. You can set that up here down below in the permissions. And so I don't even have to send them an email anymore. When they see a new file's in there, they just download it. But I'll show you what it looks like. So I'm going to send this file. And you can either, this is with the web interface. Like I said, with Outlook, it's just like using Outlook. I can send an email this way, but usually what I do is I say, give me a link that I can send. And here's the parameters you can control, which is really nice. I can have it email me when the item's been downloaded. I can require name and email before downloading. I can control access, anything from it never expires to expires after a day. I can have how many downloads per user, so they can download it once for one day, and that's it, for instance. Now, when I click Send File, I'm going to get a link, which I can then just copy to the clipboard, and I'll tell you what, I'll paste it in, because what I do is I email it to them, saying, hey, thanks, here's the ads, because I like to be friendly. Have a nice weekend. They click that link in the email, and it pulls them to this branded site, and it couldn't be easier. Do they have to sign up for ShareFile? No. They know exactly what they're going to get, a WAV file this big with this name. They press the download button and they've got it. It could not be easier. If it's a folder, it'll zip the folder up into one download. ShareFile really is the way to share files in business. In fact, if you go to ShareFile.com right now, up at the top of the page, there's a free trial waiting for you. You have to click. There's several free trials on the page. I realize this is confusing, and I apologize, but go to the link at the very top of the page at ShareFile.com where it says, you know, you hear about this on a podcast. That's right. You did. You heard about it on the Tech Guy podcast. So click that link. Podcast listeners, click here. And you can get a 30-day free trial. When they ask you, use the offer code TECHGUY so they know you heard it on our Tech Guy show. But also choose your industry. You'll see it's customizable for biotech, legal, publishing, recruiting, software, tech services, video, medical, of course, and more. They'll customize it, and it will be designed for that business. ShareFile.com. Click the link at the top of the page. Heard it on a podcast. Use the offer code TECHGUY. Try it free for 30 days. You will never, ever share files any other way again. Leo Laporte, the Tech Guy. Don't forget Chris Marquardt's 1 hour, 1,000 pictures. Supercharge your workflow in Lightroom. You can try it at the number 1 hour, H-O-U-R, the number 1,000 pics, P-I-C-S, .com. Or just go to discoverthetopfloor.com. That's Chris's site, and you'll have links to all of his work. We do have an assignment if you're interested in getting better at photography. Chris gives us an assignment every month. It's not a contest. It's just an excuse to take pictures, frankly. We're asking you to illustrate the word, the concept, the idea, three. Notice I didn't say the number. I don't know what it means. You have to figure that out. Three. And the way it works is take a picture. Take a lot of pictures. You can use your smartphone. You don't have to have a fancy camera or anything. Upload those. Find the pictures you like best. Tag them with the word three at Flickr.com. If you don't have a Flickr account, it's free. And there is a group on there, the Tech Guy group. Go to the Tech Guy group. You'll see 10,000 members and many thousands of pictures. That's the right group. And Renee Silverman's our moderator. That's another way to know. And join that group. It's free again to do that. And you upload your picture once a week. You get another picture. So a total of four. Chris is going to pick the three he likes the best, and we'll talk about them on a later show. Just for fun, no prizes. Flickr.com, Tech Guy group. We're illustrating the word or concept three. Leo Laporte, the Tech Guy. Ed is in Missoula, Montana. Hi, Ed. Leo Laporte here.
Hi, Leo. Got kind of a weird question. I was wondering if you could decrypt this Netflix Comcast agreement and its implications on other carriers.
Boy, I'm glad you asked. I've been meaning to talk about this. Okay. Today, Netflix and Comcast announced that they had made an agreement that Netflix would pay Comcast for better access to the Comcast network. This is something Netflix had been looking for some time. Netflix currently uses... So Netflix, as you probably all know, started as DVD by mail, but really their business these days is streaming movies. And it is simply the most popular streaming movie site on the net in the United States. About 40% of all internet traffic in prime time is Netflix. And I include myself. I was watching House of Cards last night, which is their Netflix original. It's a fantastic, creepy series, and I love it. And I consume it three shows at a time. And so what a lot of people have noticed, especially in prime time, is that it's very slow. Some have said Comcast is intentionally slowing down Netflix. Remember, Comcast, the nation's largest internet service provider, also has its own streaming movie service, StreamPix. So Netflix is a competitor. It's a little hard to parse what happened here, frankly. It's, in my opinion, Comcast has been intentionally slowing down Netflix and, in a sense, in my opinion, blackmailing them. If you want to reach our customers at a decent speed, you're going to have to give us more money. One of the ways Netflix would speed this up is by having a relationship with Comcast where the movies come straight from Netflix servers into Comcast's data centers. In fact, Netflix wanted to put the servers inside Comcast's data centers. Comcast declined to do that, but they will connect to Netflix servers at the data centers owned by Cogent and other companies. So it's what we call a peering relationship where Comcast and Netflix have a tighter connection than just the open internet. That means data streams faster into Comcast servers. In my opinion, Comcast is double dipping here. You pay them. I pay them. Anybody who uses them pays them for free access, free and open access to the internet. I pay them a lot of money. And I expect to be able to access every corner of the internet equally. What Comcast says is, well, yeah, but Netflix uses up a lot of bandwidth. But the next step is to go to YouTube and others, and maybe even me. I stream a lot of video to people's homes and say, if you would like full and free access to our customers, you must give us some extra money. And I feel like that isn't what the internet is about. Now, the argument is a little more complicated than that, because Netflix isn't using the free internet backbones, the open internet backbones. They want a special relationship with Comcast. So Comcast, perhaps reasonably, there's a bit of an argument. It says, well, if you want that kind of relationship, you got to pay us. According to Netflix, they had seen a severe decline in streaming speeds to Comcast since last October. According to Netflix data published in January last month, the average speed had declined 27% since October. And I bet now that could be because Netflix is more popular. But my suspicion is because Comcast is artificially strangling them. And I have to say, if you have a Comcast account, which I do, Netflix can be terrible, terrible on Comcast. Everything else is fine.
What about outside that Comcast ecosystem? For this entire winter, I'm a Charter customer. I'm a cord cutter. I don't have cable TV, and I've noticed on Charter, same thing. This entire winter, my Netflix has been lousy. So I'm wondering what the bigger implications are.
Well, it's kind of hard for us to know exactly what's going on. Now, I have an opinion, but the problem is, a lot of this is obscured by both companies. Netflix doesn't, I think, want to irritate Comcast, and Comcast certainly doesn't want to be accused of being an internet bully. Time Warner, AT&T, and Verizon all have refused to connect with Netflix's servers without getting paid. So to me, what this does is it balkanizes the internet. This is exactly what the internet – this is what we were worried about with net neutrality. It's the people who can afford to pay the big internet service providers extra for access to their – better access to the customers will. And those of us – and I include myself because my business is a streaming video business – who can't will have poor access. Now, we have yet to – this – well, time will tell if Comcast starts to throttle me – to my customers, and maybe they are, it's hard to tell. And if they ever come to me and say, here, we want money, then we'll know. They're being pirates of a different kind. It's complicated. It's not as straightforward as it might seem. And I don't think Netflix had any choice, but what it does is it really sets a precedent for other companies. You can bet Comcast is going to go hat in hand to these other companies and say, hey, Netflix paid us, you should pay us. And I don't think that's right, frankly.
Yeah. Thank you, Leo.
I'm so glad you called, because I think it's a complicated question. And it really speaks to, I believe, a free and open internet, which we all want, and it's what powers innovation in this country. The fact that a company like WhatsApp can get access to everybody who has internet access all over the world equally. Without having to pay the gatekeepers, the internet service providers, extra money. That's what made WhatsApp succeed. And it would kill small companies that are starting up if they had to pay for access to customers. We already pay our internet service providers for access to the open internet. That should be sufficient. So it worries me. It really worries me. Now, unfortunately, the chairman of the FCC is a former cable company lobbyist. He worked for these companies, so I don't expect the FCC to weigh in with any vigor. In fact, they've already decided they're not going to contest this court case that they lost that said they don't have the right to insist on internet neutrality. This is what net neutrality is all about. So it's a little disappointing to me. It is more complicated because it is not a kind of a standard internet relationship that Comcast and Netflix have. They have what's called a peering relationship. That's a little bit different, and perhaps there are some economic reasons why Comcast might want to get paid for a peering relationship. But I just worry that a free and open internet is so important to the growth, to innovation, to everything that we love about technology today, that if we allow these big companies to start to hijack the highway, put toll roads, in effect, on the highway system, that we'll lose this thing that is so precious to all of us. Well, hey, 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 how are you today? Leo Laporte here, the Tech Guy, Hour 3 of the Tech Guy program. We're talking about tech. Sure, that's computers and the internet and digital photography and home theater, but it also can be things like Comcast and Netflix. 888-ASK-LEO, that's the number. 888-827-5536. The website, and you really jot this one down because this is the all you really need to remember is techguylabs.com. The Tech Guy's Laboratory, techguylabs.com, because we put every link I mention, every story I talk about, we put up there on the website. Audio and video from each of the programs is offered on the website as well, so you can go back and you can say, hey, on last week's show, Leo answered a question about Dell computers. Let me go and listen to the answer and the question. There'll be a text as well, just synopsizing it, links to any sites and things I mentioned, and then you can also comment on it, too. So the idea, and it's always free, we don't charge for it, never will, I promise you. The idea is this is a valuable resource that you can search and find what you need. TechGuyLabs.com. You don't need to write anything down while you're listening. Just visit the website. Also links there to our great chat room and our phone number and everything else. TechGuyLabs.com. We were talking about this Netflix thing, and it's a little more complicated than Comcast simply saying, if you were to want to deliver movies to my customers, you should give me some money. It's a little more complicated than that because they want to establish a special relationship. Netflix wants to establish a special relationship. But to me, this is what Comcast should be doing because it's good for its customers. And goodness knows, Comcast charges us a lot. The cost of internet on Comcast has risen steadily year after year after year to the point, you know, Comcast realized, as did all the cable companies, that at some point you weren't going to buy HBO and Showtime and local news and all of that stuff. You're just going to watch it on the internet, and they know that. So what they've done is they've gradually increased the cost of internet so that the difference between paying for a cable subscription and internet is awfully close to paying for the internet alone. $10 more in most cases. So for $10, you'll get the cable subscription. They're smart. And now they've found another revenue source. And if you're Netflix or Amazon, if you're Google or YouTube, and you want to reach our customers in a reasonable speed so that they can watch streaming video, you're going to pay us too. It's not unprecedented, but it's not. And the point is that Comcast is a monopoly. You don't have another choice. In most areas, you have two choices for internet: your phone company, your cable company. That's it. And cable is almost always faster. So if you want the highest speed internet in your area, it's almost always going to be your cable company. It isn't a very competitive environment. If it were, we wouldn't have this problem. Because somebody would come along and say, well, forget Comcast. I'm going to offer you high-speed internet, full access to Netflix. Netflix is going to look great. That would be a selling point, wouldn't it? That would make you a customer. But Comcast knows they've got you locked in, so they can do anything they want. If they want to slow Netflix down by 27%, they can. And what are you going to do about it? Hey, what are you going to do about it? We're Comcast. You don't like it? Go somewhere else. Worst company in America. I'm telling you. The more we learn, the more depressing it is. Terrible customer service. Terrible service in general. And now they're hijacking and holding up these other companies that are giving, or the reason we get internet access, because they compete with Comcast's own streaming service. And they get away with it because the FCC has no guts. It's run by a guy who was a cable company lobbyist. That should tell you something. Members of Congress don't care because they get nice big fat checks from Comcast and other cable companies. They're fine. It's us, the users. That's the ones who suffer. And they're all doing the same thing, by the way. It's not just Comcast. They're all doing the same thing. We got, you know, I think that the solution, we've got to find a way to make the internet what it really is supposed to be, which is free and open access to the information of the world without gatekeepers, without companies extorting us, holding us up for ransom. There's got to be a way. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Jeff is in Simi Valley. You're our next caller. Hi, Jeff.
Well, Mr. Laporte.
Yes, sir.
Mr. I'm 100% in agreement with you on Comcast.
Worst company in America.
Oh, I know. I know.
Oh, and, you know, I despair because I don't think there's a whole lot we can do about it.
Oh, boy, you have to wait and see. I hope not.
They own our government. They own the FCC. You know, yeah. I don't know what to do.
Yeah, they're big, the big lobbyists there.
Yep.
Yep. Anyway, Leo, I have a 7-year-old computer with XP on it now, and I've listened to your show, and I know they're phasing out the support for that. And I need your opinion on a couple of things. I'm looking for a new laptop.
Okay.
And there's a lot on the market with 8.0 Windows and 8.1.
Yeah, well, 8.1 is the current version. Even if you buy an 8.0 computer, it will automatically update to 8.1 immediately.
Oh, it will?
Yeah. It's a free update.
Price for 8.1, is it?
It doesn't matter. It's a free over-the-air update that they do almost, you know, automatically.
Oh, I see.
And 8.1 is a nice improvement. It's a big improvement, so you do want to do it.
Now, you like Windows 7 a lot better, right?
Well, okay, so here's the deal. Windows 7's user interface, to me, is better because it's not a hybrid of a touch interface and a desktop interface. Microsoft decided after it released Windows 7 that the future of computing was moving towards tablet and touch computing. They didn't want to be left behind with what is essentially a mouse-based and a keyboard-based system. So they created a touch-based system and glommed it on top of their mouse and keyboard-based system. So it's kind of a weird hybrid. And I find that's confusing for people. For instance, there's two different Internet Explorers. There's two different versions of the browser, one for touch, one for mouse. And it's unpredictable which one you're going to be using. And to top it off, they have different user interfaces. This is bad interface design. However, however, Windows 8 improves in many ways the underlying code. It's more secure. It's faster. It fixes the broken file copy system that's been a problem in Windows since day one. So there are a lot of things that are better about 8. And what's happened is that Microsoft has realized no business is going to buy Windows 8 because they have to retrain their employees. It's too expensive. So businesses are buying Windows 7. So Microsoft, with 8.1 and with the next version, the update one, which will be coming out soon, is making it more and more like 7. Today, I would buy 8 just because it's the state of the art. That's the reason. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. February 20th article in the New York Times yesterday talking about Comcast's web of lobbying and philanthropy. Immediately after Comcast announced its plans to spend $45 billion to merge with Time Warner Cable, its tame lobbying groups started to beat the drum. The United States Hispanic Chamber of Commerce, win-win situation for America businesses. But of course, what they didn't mention is that they have collected at least $320,000 over the last 5 years from Comcast's charitable foundation. Comcast has more than 100 lobbyists registered in Washington, D.C. alone. 100. Five former members of Congress. Former FCC Commissioner Meredith Atwell Baker. This is... Now you understand why Comcast gets away with stuff like this. They spend a lot of money. We've got the finest Congress money can buy. 8888 to ask Leo. That's the phone number. We were talking about Windows 8 with Jeff, and he was reluctant. I understand he's getting a new computer, reluctant to get Windows 8. I think that you don't want to get in that same situation, Jeff, in a few years where they're discontinuing Windows 7. You might as well get the current operating system. And I do feel like Microsoft's making it easier and easier to ignore the touch interface and use the desktop.
Okay.
So I think at this point, we don't have much choice. There are companies, lots of them, still selling Windows 7. That will end on Halloween, by the way. Microsoft has decreed that HP, Dell, and others, Lenovo, still sell Windows 7 computers, will stop doing so. They must stop doing so October 31st of this year.
I see.
But again, Windows 8, by the way, in update 1 of Windows 8.1, which is due out probably May or June, that's going to bring the desktop back. You can boot to the desktop. It's going to bring the start menu back. At that point, it'll look just like Windows 7 with this additional tile thing available if you want to go there.
I see.
I think Microsoft has a little bit lost its way, I'm sorry to say. I hope their new CEO, Satya Nadella, will help them regain their mojo. I have said for a few years now that my rule of thumb is Windows for business, Windows for the office, but Macintosh for the home, for the home user. And I kind of stand by that. It is the last consumer operating system. I think Windows is really more an enterprise operating system. And ultimately, I think Microsoft will become an enterprise, a business-focused company and not a consumer-focused company. I think that's one of the reasons they put Nadella in as CEO.
Well, Leo, what about the AMD compared to...
It's fine. If you're in a budget situation, the AMD processors are less expensive. They're not as good as the Intel processors, but most people would never notice.
Really?
Yeah. I like i5s, the Intel Core Duo i5 based on the fourth generation, the Haswell processors. Better battery life, better speed, better processing, but they are more expensive. So budget computers often have AMD processors.
Uh-huh.
That's fine.
Now, is there any problem transferring my files from XP to 8.0?
No, Microsoft has a transfer wizard that'll make that pretty easy. I would use this as an opportunity anyway to back up your data, put it on an external hard drive.
Right.
It's just an excuse to do it, and it's in that you can never go wrong having more copies of your stuff.
So my word processing.
Now apps, you're going to have to. You can't just copy over. Obviously, you'll have to reinstall your applications.
So I have to buy a new one.
Yeah, you know what they've done, though, and I think this is good. I would look at Microsoft's new Office. I take it you use Microsoft Word?
Yes.
Yeah. Their new Office deal is inexpensive. I think it's a monthly fee. I think it's $10 a month, $8 a month, something like that. And it's great. You can install it on multiple computers. It's updated automatically. It's secure automatically. I think Office 365 is a very good choice, and that's what I use, actually.
Okay.
It's a subscription. Sometimes that makes them a little nervous. But, you know, the sticker shock of going to buy a new copy of Office is pretty steep. I when the last Office came out, that was like $300, and I just couldn't bring myself to spend $300 for Office.
Right.
So the monthly fee is a lot less, even, you know, over a year or two. And it's automatically updated. It's kept up to date and so forth. The other choice is, of course, office.com, which is online only, and that's free. And
right.
For many people who don't have, you know, don't really need heavy-duty word processing, it's a very good choice.
So no problem transferring my files to...
Applications are the issue. You'll have to reinstall them, and you will want to update them because apps that were written for Windows XP, probably time to get new ones.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And... my security system, my Norton and Linksys Wi-Fi, had worked fine with that?
Absolutely.
Okay. And what about, I understand I read an article this morning in the Wall Street Journal that the printer drivers may not work.
Well, that's right, because your printer is it of the same vintage as your office, as your XP?
Yes.
Yeah. Well, yeah, they may not have written... That printer is so old, that just like Microsoft doesn't want to update XP, the company that made that printer probably isn't making updated drivers. Often, though, drivers for Vista or later will work. So, you know, this is the cascade, unfortunately, the upgrade cascade. You upgrade one thing, and then you have to upgrade a bunch more, and you may find, in fact, that your old printer doesn't work with Windows 8. You should check. There's a compatibility checker.
If it doesn't work, then I need to buy a new printer.
Yeah, but printers are cheap,
yeah.
Like really cheap.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So you don't see a problem going to 8.0.
Everybody's doing it. All the kids, all the cool kids are doing it. I mean, this is kind of...
Well, I know, but I know you always said 7 was the best.
Well, eventually you just have to say, we're just going to bite the bullet and make the move, because what are you going to do? The times have changed. And we at some point you have to do it. So Office 365 Home Premium, which includes Word, Excel, PowerPoint, OneNote, which is an excellent application, with $99 a year. You can do a monthly, but $99 a year. Do you use Outlook?
No.
Okay. You also get Skype calling for free for a year, so, and some storage on there on what was called SkyDrive is now called OneDrive.
Can you just buy Word without the other?
No, of course not. That would be that would be crazy talk.
Oh, I see.
Actually, I don't know. Can you? I always see Office. I don't ever see Word.
Oh, okay.
Can you? Let me ask the chat room. Can you just buy? You ought to be able to. Word standalone. Let's look at the Microsoft store here. Office 365 Home and Student, Office 365 Home Premium. If they sell Word by itself, they don't list it on their website.
Okay.
Wait a minute, here it is. Yeah, $109, Word 2013. It's cheaper to buy Office. $109. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. I'm built to perform as well. I started doing this in 1976, before you were born, Heather. I started doing this, and I've been doing it. What is that? I'm now in my 38th year as a broadcaster. Briefly, when I hit 30, so that was in the 80s, I thought this is a silly job for a grown-up. So I decided to get a real, quote, real job. And it turned out, because I was really, I knew a lot about computers. I knew how to program. And so I got a job at a startup. It was called Paracomp. And the idea was, this was in the 1986, to parallel computing, originally for science. But then we broadened it to other applications. And eventually, by the way, the company merged with Macromedia and then sold to Adobe. And I think the founders made quite a bit of money. I should have made money, but the problem was I did it for 3 months, worked in this startup, and I realized this is not me. I would stand up in the little cubicle farm and I'd do 10 minutes. I do comedy because I'm built to perform. So 3 months of that, I said, you can keep your stock. You're never going anywhere anyway. And I'm going back to radio. Yeah, I could have been one of those kids, living on the beach, enjoying life. But no, actually, it was the right thing to do. I'm very glad. It's kind of an interesting thing. I've been a tech guy. I've been covering this business since the 70s. I started writing for Byte and InfoWorld magazine in the late 70s. I've been doing a show like this, very much like this, since the early 90s, since Windows 3.1 and DOS 5. And so I've watched this whole thing happen, the tech boom. I've watched friends of mine have become millionaires. They've had their own little startups. They've taken off. They've gone places. And I've just been on the sidelines watching. And every once in a while, I thought, I should have really, if I had just thought of doing a messenger app that I could have sold to Microsoft or Facebook or Yahoo for billions of dollars, I could own a professional basketball team right now. I could be have courtside seats. But no, I like being on this. I realized the reason I wasn't happy in the startup business is because I had to focus on one company, one sector, and I'm fascinated by all of it. I've got ringside seats for a world that is absolutely changing. This is the industrial revolution for our time. Just look around you. It 10 years ago, did people spend all their time looking at a little screen in their hand as they walked through the middle of the traffic? No. The world has changed. I get in my car and I see a satellite map of where I am with my car superimposed on it. We live in the future. It's a pretty exciting time. And I feel very privileged to get to to watch this, to meet the people who are changing the world. Yeah, sure, they're getting rich, but I feel like we're having fun. This is the best job for a journalist because nobody dies. There's nobody sheds blood in this, but these stories are changing. We're covering stuff that's changing our lives. Everything from how we work, how we play, how we worship, how we communicate. The world is changing. Let's move on. More calls. Hamid is next in Danbury, Connecticut. Hi, Hamid.
Hello, Leo. It's Hamid again. You remember me? I'm the guy that was talking to about surround sound and stuff. I made a video on my iPhone.
Okay.
That I'm going to upload on YouTube, and I don't know how the heck you even do that. I know you have to use iTunes for everything, so I don't understand how you do it.
I think your phone can do it. If you have a YouTube account registered on your phone? Don't you? No, I haven't. Yes, Heather's an iPhone user. I haven't used one in a while. You press a button and it uploads to YouTube. You got to, but the key is you have to sign up for your YouTube account on the phone. YouTube, Vimeo, Facebook, and Twitter are all now built into iOS, automatic sharing to those if you have iOS 7. So presuming you have them, even iOS 6 did YouTube, presuming you have the most recent version of iOS. But the problem is you have to make sure you attach those accounts on your phone. Once you do, then on the video, there'll be a share button. You press it and it says, send it to my YouTube account. It's pretty straightforward. You're right. You can also, if you wish, connect it up to iTunes, download it onto your computer and do it from there. But I can't see any reason. Now, if you're worried about 3G bandwidth, if you've got bandwidth caps on your cell carrier, do it on Wi-Fi. Don't do it when you're out in the road. There's also a YouTube app. John in the chat room reminds me. You can download the YouTube app on your iPhone. Unlike Windows Phone, there's a very good YouTube app for iPhone, and you can do that. But the YouTube Capture app will do it as well. That's another app. Wow, we're coming up with all sorts of ways to do this. If you shoot your video in the YouTube Capture app, uploads automatic. But in any event, this is one thing that Apple makes very easy. Twitter, Facebook, YouTube, and Vimeo are all kind of built into the operating system. By the way, if you do use iOS, very, very important, you should get an update announcement. You should have gotten one yesterday. Do not ignore it. Update your iOS to 7.0.6. If you're running an older version of iOS, check for an update there, too. There's a very serious flaw in iOS that allows a bad guy to exercise something called a man-in-the-middle attack. The bad guy gets between you and a secure server like your bank, Amazon, anywhere you're having a secure SSL communication, and can actually intercept what is normally secure encrypted data. It's a serious flaw, so serious that Apple's released an emergency update. We are expecting the big update to iOS 7.1 to come out in March. But in the meantime, this is not something to wait for. And apparently it's a flaw also in OS 10 in Mavericks, but they haven't issued a fix for it yet, which is a cause for concern. It's probably a little more difficult to fix on the desktop than it is on the phone and the iPad. But boy, keep an eye peeled for an Apple update and apply it immediately if you can. Is it serious enough that I would stop communicating with my bank? Well, gosh, that's hard for me to say. If you can avoid using an SSL connection, like don't buy anything online, don't communicate with your bank, don't get your email. If you can avoid it, I would. I imagine Apple will have an update soon. Apple says it's coming very soon. They're working, I'm sure. I'm sure there are people at Apple who did not go to bed last night. But last time I checked, there was no update. So yeah, if I were you, I would have. If you can delay it, do. I have not. I've done it. I bought something online this morning because I'm an addict and I can't stop myself. It's just something to be careful of. Very important update, Hamid. Dave Hamilton, Montana, Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Hi, Dave.
Hi, Leo. How are you doing?
I'm well. How are you?
Good. Hey, I have a Motorola Razr M. Got it about a year ago.
Very nice phone.
I like it. 2 months ago, I got a Bluetooth headset. It works great. It would attach itself to the voice commands on the phone when I press the little button on the
Yeah, that's nice, isn't it? Yeah, yeah.
And I could talk to it and make it dial, and then
one day it quit doing that. It would connect itself to Google on the phone, but it wouldn't go to the voice commands app anymore. And I exchanged the headset, got a brand new headset.
Yeah, it sounds like it's the phone, but I'm afraid I'm not going to be much help here. I don't know. Let me think about it, and we'll come back. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Last segment of the day of the show. Going to see if I can get some calls in here. I did not find anybody who had a suggestion. It seems to me that Android, and I'm pretty sure the Droid M would count, does have settings where you say that are related to this, whether your voice commands work. I would check the settings. I'm not sure why it would ignore you, Dave.
I don't know either.
I don't think it's the headset. I think it's just the settings.
Yeah, I took it to the Verizon store, and they suggested I get an iPhone.
Why, I oughta. You know, they get a little cash payment when you trade up to the iPhone. Look in the.
I had two different people look at it. Nobody can figure it out.
Nobody in the chat room has any good idea, but I do think it is in the settings. It is, has something to do with voice command. It's a Droid, so it would be. Does it use the Google voice commands, or is it using its own?
Yeah, there was an app that came on the phone called Voice Command.
Yeah, so it's. Yeah. The mic works otherwise. You can make phone calls and everything.
Oh, yeah.
Do you hear a beep when you press the button? Does it signal, oh, I hear you?
It beeps, but then it doesn't do anything when I look at the
Here's phone. What I, you know, okay, here's an interesting... Google, yeah, go into... Check Google Now and make sure you've got Google Now enabled. I bet you it updated, and Google Now is now kind of the interface for all that. You go to the settings and language and input and make sure you've got it set there correctly. But I bet you also have to opt in to Google Now.
Oh, okay.
So if you have the Google search bar on there, just tap it. It'll open Google Now. Make sure you opt into that. It may be that I bet you this is what happened. It updated its Android, and Google Now takes over a lot of this voice command stuff. And I bet you anything that you haven't opted in, and that's why it's ignoring you. As soon as you opt in, it'll start working again.
Oh, okay. Yeah. I'll give that a try.
What version is it? 4.2? Bet it is.
4.1, I think.
Well, look for a system update. The Motorola X and the later Droids, you just say, okay, Google Now, and it listens, and it goes, hello. Oh, it just did. On my phone. So that's try OK Google or OK Google Now. Go into this. I'm busy. I'm working. it's saying, hi there, Leo. Can I help you? I think it's something in there.
Okay.
All right, Richard. That'd be my best guess. I mean, David. Now Richard in Santa Clarita. Hi, Richard. Leo Laporte, the tech guy.
Hi, Leo. So I've been doing a podcast, and I want to start doing some video. And I have a Canon T3i.
Excellent.
And I got an extra microphone, and I plugged it into the camera. And, boy, the sound quality was terrible.
Yes. Yes. So the on-camera microphones almost always are. Even when we had camcorders, they were. You'd hear the camera guy going, okay, hit it, Jimmy. Okay, Dad. So it's the on-camera microphone's the problem. Does your Canon have an external mic connector? Usually it's a mini jack.
No, that's what I'm saying. I got a microphone and plugged it into the camera.
Oh,
it was an external mic.
Right. But it didn't work very well.
No, the sound quality was really
so. I use Rode's stereo mic. They call it the stereo video mic. It goes. What's nice is it mounts into the hot shoe for the flash, and then the little cable goes into the hole on the side of the camera. And the quality is superb, and it's stereo. It even comes with, pardon me, what they call a dead kitten, which is a giant muff that goes on the thing. That keeps the wind sound down, and I've had excellent results recording with this on a Canon camera. So my suspicion is you just didn't get a great microphone.
Huh. I thought it was a really good quality, but Now, I've also heard of this magic lantern, but it looks kind of intimidating to me to use.
Well, that would be
familiar with this.
That would be after the fact. That software. The Magic Lantern firmware. Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. I don't know if that would make the sound better. It's fine. I use Magic Lantern all the time on my. This is a firmware update. It was one of the reasons to get a Canon camera. It's a firmware update that gives you more capability. I don't know if it would improve the sound quality. Does it say it will?
Yeah, I thought that was one of the things it was used for.
All right, audio. Analog digital gain adjustments, selectable import, toggle wind filter, live audio monitoring. Yeah, I mean, it gives you more capabilities. I don't know if it's going to improve the quality.
Okay, so the other option would be to record the sound on a separate device, but then I would have to sync all of it.
Yeah. What mic did you get?
Boy, I don't remember the name.
I think, you know, there are bad mics out there. I think you need, get the Rode. I've used it. I continue to use it. It's a great microphone. It's called the video stereo mic. It's got left and right stereo. Stereo video mic. I'm sorry. Let me just see what the cost of this is. You know, you also might try. Now, that one's right on the camera, so it's good for ambient sound. It's good for a baseball game, that kind of thing. If you have somebody who's 10 feet away and you just want their voice, you're going to want to get a shotgun mic, which is much more directional. You can also get those. But if you get a $10 microphone off eBay and it sounds bad, well, I'm not surprised. I think you need to get a better mic. Would be my guess. I don't think the firmware is going to make a difference. It gives you more capabilities, but it doesn't make the sound quality better. Do we have time? Might have time for Joe. Let's see if we can get it in Chickatawaga, New York. Hi, Joe. Leo Laporte, the tech guy.
Good afternoon. I know when we donate computers and smartphones and start stuff like that, we're supposed to use something like D-band to completely wipe the information out of the device,
right.
And we know it doesn't work so well for SSDs because
right.
you can't. Now, it occurred to me the other day when in my mom's escape that Ford Sync, it has all this potentially personal information. It has Bluetooth pairings. It has contact information. How do I deband a Ford vehicle?
Oh, that's a good question. That's a great question. So you're going to sell your car. I mean, I would wipe it. It is, you know, there is the capability in all of these cars to delete the pairings, to delete the data and all of that. But I have to tell you, many's the time I've gotten in a rental car and it's been loaded with everybody else's phone book and I could see all the names of the people who used it. The GPS, I could see places they went. In fact, isn't there a movie where that's how they find the bad guy because they get the car that he rented and they go back to the same place he went to last time? So you make a very good point. The good news is it would take a fairly sophisticated bad guy to get the data off of there. He'd have to get the hard drive out of it and so forth. Mm-hmm. The bad news is I don't know of an easy way to do it. There's no D-band for Fords that I know of. That's a very good question. I guess you're stuck. All you can do is use the built-in capability to delete accounts, delete that information, you know, clear your GPS data, and then make sure when you sell the car, you sell it to a nice person. If he looks shady, don't sell it to him. And if you're a bad guy on the run, hey, thanks for the call. Thanks for the questions. Thanks for joining me this weekend. I'll see you next weekend. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Well, that's it for the Tech Guy show for today. I'm Leo Laporte. Thank you so much for joining us. Don't forget, the Tech Guy is just the tip of the iceberg. We do nearly 30 shows now on the Twit Netcast Network, and you'll find them all at twit.tv. We talk about Windows on Windows Weekly, Macintosh on MacBreak Weekly, iPad on iPad Today. You get your daily dose of tech news from Tech News Today and our weekly roundtable show, This Week in Tech. It's all at twit.tv. And I'll be back next time with another great Tech Guy podcast. Thanks for joining me. See you next time.